Where warp meets weft. Where warp meets weft. This is Weavecast with Syne Mitchell.
Hello, and welcome to episode 31, Complicated Weavers. This episode, Weavecast goes to the Complex Weavers Seminar. Traditionally, this follows right after Convergence, and this year it was in St. Petersburg at Eckerd College. After that, we interview the enormously talented Peter Collingwood, and then I talk about my post-conference struggles with an affliction that strikes down many a weaver. Loom lust. There's a lot going on in terms of hand-weaving publications right now. The latest issue of Craft magazine, this is a print publication, issue 8, is all about weaving. If you've not seen this, you should go check it out. I'll have a link to this up on the show notes. Handwoven has a new look and an online forum. It's on their Knitting Daily site. Another publication is called Living Craft magazine. I recently ran into this on the shelves of my local food co-op, and it is just really sweet and wholesome and wonderful, and its focus seems to be on crafts to do with kids. Basically, if you are running a Waldorf school, you need a copy of this magazine. And if you're not running a Waldorf school and you just like really cool crafts that harken back to a softer, gentler time, Living Craft magazine speaks to that. There is a social networking site for weavers in development. Tian Chu and Claudia Siegel are working on something called Weevolution. They're hoping to launch in spring 2009. They were inspired by Ravelry, but since Ravelry has not yet come across with the weaving glove, the weavers are doing it for themselves. I'll be watching that with interest. And although it's not a weaving publication, I am so excited that I had my first article published in Knitty. This was an idea that sprung out of the Knit One, Weave One that I did with Brenda Dane in the summer issue of Weavezine. And we had been having some trouble swatching colors to like you do one strand of one color and one strand of another color and find something that worked. And in the process of swatching for that, I got addicted to knitting these little tiny color swatches, and I realized that you could actually make a color gamp in knitting just like you do in weaving. The results are different because the two crafts intermingle fiber differently, but it was really interesting, and I will have a link to that as well in the show notes so you can see what that's all about. On the Weavezine side of things, I launched a readership survey with the fall issue, and the results from that are really interesting. Some of the guesses I'd made about the audience for Weavezine were dead on, and others were surprises. One of the interesting things that came out of that survey was that only about half of the people who read Weavezine listen to Weavecast. So I'm curious, do you read Weavezine? I've put a poll up on the Weavecast show notes, and it will just take a second to go up there and click a button. I would really appreciate it if you'd let me know if you read Weavezine. And the show notes, if you haven't been there in a while, is www.weavecast.com. So that's a lot of publishing news with regards to weaving. All I can say is, does it seem like weaving is having a resurgence? Is it too early to say that? I'm not sure, but it really feels as though things are afoot in the world of weaving. Our sponsor this episode is Complex Weavers. They are a volunteer-run organization that promotes hand-weaving education, especially in the areas of multi-shaft weaving. But even if you're not weaving on a multi-shaft loom, Complex Weavers can help you take your weaving to the next level. Check them out online at www.complex-weavers.org. I will have a link to that on the show notes. After Convergence, I went to the Complex Weavers seminars. Now, Convergence is this big, glossy, polished show. And Complex Weavers is like summer camp. You go, you stay in a dorm room, you take classes all day, you eat in a cafeteria together. And it had that kind of summer camp camaraderie. And it was a much smaller event, so you kept running into the same people over and over again. I really treasured my time at Complex Weavers. The only one regret I had was I was so sleep-deprived after Convergence that Complex Weavers was a bit of a blur to me. So I did my very best to pay attention in class. I took lots of notes and pictures, and hopefully when I review that, it'll all come back to me. But I met a lot of wonderful people there. And if you've never been to a Complex Weaver seminar and you're a little hesitant because you don't have the 24 shaft loom, I got to tell you, I went to Complex Weavers and all I had was an 8 shaft loom. And I ended up sitting in class next to some lady who had a 4 shaft loom. And we still got quite a bit out of it. I mean, it's a little bit frustrating because you can see how far you could take weaving if you had more shafts. But the innovations that the teachers are introducing still apply to, shall we say, more modest looms. One of the things that struck me while I was listening back to the audio I recorded at Convergence is that I spoke to teachers, to vendors, to attendees, to guys in the lobby playing accordion, but I never spoke to the one group who made it all possible, the folks who volunteered and put together Convergence. So when I realized this, I cornered Penny Peters, who was the chair for Complex Weaver Seminars, and asked her to give me some of the behind-the-scenes scoop as to what goes into pulling off a weaving conference and just what makes someone give up their weaving time to work incredibly hard for no money. At what point did you become involved in volunteering for weaving organizations?
1999 was the first big organizing I did, and I organized tours for the 1999 Conference of Northern California Hand Weavers.
What drew you into that?
It's like most volunteer activities. Somebody looks you in the face and asks you, and you haven't got the nerve to say no.
So what goes into putting on a conference like Complex Weavers?
Complex Weavers is a specific kind of conference with a history. And so organizing the conference is easy on the one side because you have a model to follow. There's an organizational culture that will dictate a lot of what you will do. You then have to find a committee that will work together. And it was very easy to do that at Grand Rapids because I could look everyone easily in the eye and they couldn't easily say no. It is the best way to get volunteers. And you can start from there brainstorming and then delineate from that brainstorming exactly what direction you want to take the conference in, because each conference will have its own flavor as far as teachers, even where the setting is. That's a large part of it. And there's also a lot of email. Most of the people on these conferences, especially for Complex Weavers, we are very separated by miles. We depend on email to make decisions, do our brainstorming, talk things out, send files back and forth. It's several hours a day on email. And that keeps us going.
You being from Berkeley and the conference being in St. Petersburg, was that challenging?
Well, my first job was to try and find a local liaison and let them do the groundwork. But there aren't that many complex weavers in Florida, so I could not find someone who was free to do it because most people were tied up working with Convergence. So I used the internet. Some of the Florida people could tell me good sources to at least look at. And then I had to make a trip out here to see the site.
What surprised you the most about putting on Complex Weavers?
Probably the passion that people approached it with. People really care about this seminar, whether they're actually on the organizing committee or not. It's a very important part of Complex Weavers' life. And it's just such an important forum for transferring information, meeting new people, meeting old friends. People are passionate about it. They have their opinions.
How many people got involved and actually made this conference happen? I mean, excluding the teachers, excluding the participants. I mean, how big a staff does it take to put one of these on?
Every conference is different. Some people do it with more or less. I chose five core people that helped me throughout the whole 2 years of planning, and these five people did most of the work. Ruth Blau and Janet Stolnitz did all of the work on the education end of it. They invited teachers or asked for proposals. They reviewed the proposals, and just innumerable jobs that go along with that. And Sandra Rue joined them for part of it to edit the proposals and choose classes. Kathy McCarthy did the registration end of it, and again, it's just an incredible amount of detail work went into that. Thank God for email, because it made a huge difference in what she was able to accomplish and how we were able to allay people's fears and questions and anxieties about what to expect when they came. And then Marg Coe did the print and publicity, which we thought was going to be a simple job, turned out to be very difficult in the long run. It involved putting the registration book together, which is a huge job, and that's done almost a year in advance. And then she became very involved in our film project for Peter Collingwood.
Yeah, tell me about the biggest challenge you had to overcome for this particular Complex Weavers.
Well, I had a very special problem. We went out on a limb and we asked Peter Collingwood to come. And I say out on a limb because we knew that Peter was elderly and he had not traveled out of the country. But we had decided that his presence was important enough that we would at least ask. And he graciously consented. And actually, he was really looking forward to coming, as well as we were just really anxious to have him. But as it came very close to the end, Peter's maladies became much more severe, and he really knew he couldn't travel. Then we had to decide what to do about a keynote speaker. And you go through the motions of, well, do we really need a keynote speaker? Well, should we do this person or should we do that person? Well, they're going to be insulted if you ask someone and they think they're just a plug-in.
I want to go back for a minute to that moment. What's it like when you get the phone call or the email that says, sorry, can't come? What's that like?
Actually, with Peter, it was almost as if I was waiting for the other shoe to drop anyway, because we had been concerned about that from the beginning. So while it wasn't a shock, it was a surprise. And I was very proud of myself, because rather than panic, which is my normal reaction, I said, I have an absolutely incredible committee. I'm just going to go to the internet. I am going to forward the email so they know what is going on. And I know we will come together and come up with something wonderful. And that's exactly what happened. We brainstormed for a while on what to do. And then Janet Stolnitz came up with the idea of, well, if Peter can't come to us, why don't we go to Peter? And I thought about it for a while, and it sounded like a brilliant idea to me. And then two people were suggested in England who were very active with Complex Weavers and, in fact, had been registered for the conference. And I emailed them and asked them, would they please consider doing a film of Peter to substitute for his visit here? And both of them, this Wendy Morris and Stacey Harvey Brown, took up the challenge with gusto and just did an incredible job of getting a professional videographer in and doing an incredible filming job with Peter. It's just such a gift to the weaving world. So what was lemons turned out to be a wonderful lemonade.
I saw the premiere of the DVD yesterday at Complex Weavers, and it was an amazing record of Peter and his work and his innovations. And I think, like you said, lemonade out of lemons is almost better because now we've got it recorded, and so people who even aren't at Complex Weavers for this event can benefit from it.
Complex Weavers will be selling copies of the discs. I hope people take advantage of it. We're putting a very reasonable price on it because we really want this seen by as many weavers as possible. It's a wonderful piece of work that illustrates Peter's personality, his wonderful weavings that he himself has collected, and then there's this wonderful explanation of how to do macro gauzes and how to do shaft switching. It seems so simple, as Peter would say, when you find out how he did it. It's really a wonderful slant on weaving and different from what we are used to experiencing.
Before you get involved with volunteering, did you understand how much work is involved?
Nobody would get involved with volunteering if they understood how much work was involved. The pleasure of the work is usually in the result. The work itself can be fun as you develop friendships, which I enjoy. I enjoy that part of it a lot. And then the reward, for me personally, seeing people become excited and grow with whatever program has been brought, whether it's an exhibition or whether it's a workshop that you've done or whether it's a conference. When you see people really excited and happy and they can't wait to get back to their looms, it's a wonderful reward for the amount of work.
What advice would you give that person who has been looked at in the eye and has said, yes, I will chair, you know, such and such a thing? What would you pass on to them?
I think the first thing I do is tell them to set their goals high. Set your goals high and then know that that conference will meet your goals no matter what. It will meet your goals. The other thing I'd say to them is take it all with a grain of salt. Nothing is personal. And have fun.
Well, I really do appreciate all the work, and I can't even imagine how much you and your staff have put into this. What's the next thing for you?
Weaving. I've spent 2 years talking about weaving, and I'm really looking forward to getting home to my, what is almost still new to me, loom that I bought at the last Convergence, and trying to learn how to really use that tool.
Cool. And just out of curiosity, what loom is that?
I bought a Toyka 32 shaft loom that I absolutely love.
I am very honored to be talking on the telephone all the way from a little village outside Colchester, England, with Peter Collingwood. So welcome.
Thank you.
How did you get started with weaving?
I knew I was better at making things than doing almost anything else. And I became a doctor and qualified. And while I was doing my internship as a house surgeon, there was an occupational therapy department with some looms in it, and nobody was using them. Nobody knew how to use them. And it just intrigued me as a machine. I couldn't sort of see how the thing worked. So I just wanted to find out how a loom worked. And so I made myself a very primitive loom, a bit like an Inkle loom. I made it from some old deck chairs. So it was an Inkle loom that wove about a foot wide and had four shafts. I could weave one scarf on it, and then I had to put on a new warp. That was just going on while I was being a doctor. As I did that, I had no idea, you know, one could live from being a weaver or that I would carry on doing it. I just did that as a thing of interest. And then after the time in the hospital, and I had to be called up in the army because it was just after the war, then I went into the Red Cross, and in the Red Cross in Jordan, I saw village weavers at work. And I collected a few rugs there. I think it was working in Jordan really made me realize that I was utterly hopeless at being a doctor, and I felt confident I could do something with weaving. So when I came back from that stint in Jordan, I went to Ethel Merriam. She was the most famous English weaver at that time. She said, could I work here for a bit? I think she was rather intrigued that a man should be asking to do this. So I went to her for a few months, and then I went on to Barbara Sawyer, and then from her to Alistair Morton. Without knowing it, I went to the three best production weavers at the time. I was very lucky to get handed on from one to the other. So I had a training like that, nothing to do with art schools at all.
So how was it making the transition from working as a doctor to supporting yourself with weaving? What was that like?
Well, it was very easy to stop being a doctor. But of course, everyone in my family thought this was absurd, because being a doctor, you've got guaranteed income. But luckily, my mother was very supportive. I think the fact that I did this switch made me a more determined weaver than otherwise, because I just had to prove to people that I wasn't stupid to have given up medicine. I had to prove to them that I'd made the correct choice.
How did you come to specialize in rug weaving?
The last person I worked with was Alistair Morton, and when I was there, I learned some rug techniques from him, corduroy and some block weaves. When I left from him and set up my own workshop in London, I had to decide what I was going to do. And if you're going to survive in hand weaving, you have to produce something that nobody else is producing. You have to be able to produce it quickly so it's not too expensive. And it has to be something you like producing yourself. It has to be those three things. And I like the idea of a rug being a unit of design in itself. It's not like weaving yardage, where you weave 10 yards and then somebody else chops it up and makes clothes or curtains or upholstery from it. A rug is a unit of design with four sides. It's rather like composing a picture, isn't it?
Did you end up working with architects and designers?
I ended by, yes, certainly not by beginning, because to begin with, nobody knows anything about you at all. So I began by making my own rugs in my own ways, different sorts of block weaves. I extended the corduroy method into double corduroy to make the pile closer. And I just sold direct to people and to the three shops in London which dealt with handmade things. So I would make a few rugs and strap them to the handlebars of a bicycle and go off to one of these three shops and sell them for, I think the first ones I made were £4 each, $8 each.
You've written several books that have become mainstays of the literature of hand weaving. What got you into writing these books?
Well, the first one was the rug one. I'd been teaching for a bit at art school, teaching rug weaving, and I began teaching my own ideas, and I began seeing these ideas in other people's books, and I sort of rather egotistically thought, I thought of this, I ought to be kudos for doing this. So I began by putting down everything I knew about rug weaving. But of course, as I wrote it, I found huge areas of which I knew absolutely nothing about, using twills in a weft face rug. I knew very little about warp face rugs. So it was a matter of learning as I wrote it. So all the time I was putting on little sample warps on a small loom and working things out, to doing 6-shaft, 8-shaft twills, doing up to 8-shaft block weaves, just trying and trying to find ways which hadn't been used before applied to rug weaving. Quite often this meant taking a structure normally used for fine fabrics and blowing it up so it became a heavy fabric for the floor.
They're wonderfully comprehensive, and in fact, sometimes when I'm looking up a technique that I want to use in fine fabric, I'll turn to your rug weaving book, because it's got such wonderful illustrations and such a clear explanation of the technique.
Thank you. That's not a question, that's a statement.
You deserve kudos. The books are just magnificent. You also were very involved in tablet weaving. How did you get into that?
I first sort of learnt about it from Mary Atwater's Byways in Hand Weaving. She's got one chapter on it. I just tried that out. So when I'd done the rug book, I wondered if I could apply this idea of trying to include everything to another textile structure, making it sort of the big book on the subject. There didn't seem any point in making a little fiddly book, sort of 60 pages. I wanted to make a book which dealt with the subject completely. And after the rug book, the first one I did was Sprang, and then after that it was the tablet weave book. It always intrigues me the way threads can be manipulated to make a coherent fabric and ways other than interlacing. You can twist the warp as in tablet weaving. You can interlink the warp as in Sprang. You can make the warp pierce the warp as in ply splitting. It's been an ongoing interest trying to find out all these ways that clever people in the past have found of taking this sort of bendy thing, thread, and making it into a strong, coherent fabric.
You had done a lot of work altering looms. Can you tell me about that?
Well, I never bought a loom which was called a rug loom. So one has got to strengthen a loom if you're going to subject it to the tensions and banging that a rug loom gets. So I always added strength to the ratchet on the warp beam. I perhaps added an extra pull to the ratchet on the cloth beam, so you get sort of two clicks instead of one, get a better control of the tension. I've always put a heavy weight under the beater, so you can just beat up the weft with a single bang.
What did you use as your weight?
Well, I just went to a junkyard and bought something about, I don't know, 2 inches by half an inch section, and as long as the beater was wide. I remember at the time you read accounts of how you put the weft in, beat once, change the shade, beat once again, and this just seems stupid to me. You look at a power loom, and it just beats once. Why waste the time beating two or three times? If there was a problem, I often tried to find out what was done in a factory, because they're really working things out scientifically. There's no emotional connection with machinery in a factory. The thing's just got to work. If a weaving factory has found that something works, then it's worth investigating it to see if you can put it on a hand loom. The other alterations I've done, this warp extender, which means that you never have any problems with warp tension. That's rather too difficult to describe it over the phone, but it's pictured in my rug books.
Isn't that the thing that stretches the warp out?
Yes, that's right. You either stretch it out horizontally or vertically. So the actual warp you're going to use for a rug is off the warp beam before you begin. So you tie it onto your front stick. Then as you weave and you want to turn on, you don't touch the warp beam at all. You just move this extension towards the loom, give yourself more warp. So if you've tied on correctly at the beginning, the tension is bound to stay absolutely perfect to the end. You don't get all these problems, which are so annoying, loose threads. In fact, you can make quite a bad warp. It can look all sort of lumpy and bumpy on the warp beam, but because you're using a warp extender, it works perfectly. The reason why you get bad threads is because your warping isn't perfect. You've put on the warp with some threads a little bit tighter than others, and the surface of the warp beam isn't absolutely smooth, so you get little hollows and mountain ranges. But if you extend all the warp you want from the warp beam before you weave, inequalities on the warp beam don't matter at all, because the warp you're going to use is off the warp beam to begin with. So it works very well if you've got the space to do it. I generally had it extending backwards horizontally, but when we did the Harrisville rug loom, they extended it upwards, because most people have got more upward space than backward space.
You worked with Harrisville.
That was after I thought of the shaft switching principle. I wrote to all the loom makers I could think of, saying, I've got this wonderful idea, you can have it for nothing. And not a single one replied to me. I think because I said it was for nothing that they thought it couldn't be worth anything. And finally, Harrisville Designs in New Hampshire were convinced, and they came and visited me, had a good look at it, and then they made a loom, and I went over and looked at what they'd done. Finally, they came up with the design, which sells now. I get a royalty for each one that's sold. It seems to be almost regarded as normal now. When I thought of it, nobody was doing cross stitching, nobody had thought of it. Now, if you look at a rug exhibition, quite likely you'll find about half of the rugs have been done by cross stitching, because it gives you such freedom of design.
What is shaft switching?
This is telephone. How can I tell you? Well, in a block weave, imagine a black rug with white blocks on it. And you've threaded the rug, so where you want the black to show, it's threaded in a certain way. Where you want the blocks to show, you thread it slightly differently. You're throwing two shuttles, black and white, alternately, pressing four pedals in a certain sequence, and these blocks will appear automatically because you have threaded it slightly differently where you want the blocks. What shaft switching does is to change the threading I used for the blocks for the threading I used in the background, so which immediately means you can move the blocks around. They don't have to be little rectangles always in the same point in the rug. So immediately you're free to do any two-color design as quickly as a simple block weave, which nobody had done before.
Where did that inspiration come from?
It was pretty obvious that the difference between the threading for the block and the threading for the background was just a single thread. Every third thread was slightly differently threaded between the block and the background structure. So if you could somehow move a warp thread from one shaft to another, you could change from the block threading to the background threading. So that's what the shaft switching does, fully explained in my rug books.
What in general inspires your rug designs?
Using this shaft switching principle, which is the only one I've used for years and years, and, well, I haven't made any rugs for years and years, but that's the last technique I used. You're, as it were, designing on a grid, little squares, each of which is 3/4 inch square. So anything you can draw on that grid, filling in those little squares, you can produce on your rug. So you can draw out this grid and begin filling them in and seeing if you like this, like that. But as with any designing, there comes a moment when you have to make decisions. That's the difficult part. There's no one there to tell you that this is a better idea than that. You've got to do it yourself. I have this idea that if you live in a house where everything around you is something which you think is good to look at, something which is beautiful, your eyes get trained to judge what is good to look at. So if in your designing you wonder whether to do A or B, you have to ask your eyes, which is better, which is more pleasing, which is more beautiful, whatever word you like to use. And you go with that, and you hope that when the rug is finished that you made the right decision. Only once did I base a rug on something I saw in nature, and it was a complete flop. Got quite hopeless. So they're always geometric, simple, trying not to look like a Middle Eastern rug so they don't have borders, trying to be asymmetrical, which traditional rugs aren't. I've even put words on them. There's one that had the word peace written all over it, which made up a sort of diamond in the middle. If you see them, you would see that there's a certain style, I suppose, which is trying to use the possibilities of shaft switching. At any moment, you can only use two colors, but those two colors can change. So you might start the work with black and white, and then it changes to gray and white and to gray and yellow or something. But you can't use three colors together in a horizontal line in the rug. It's just a limitation you have to accept.
What are you working on currently?
My archive. I'm not doing any weaving. Just all the stuff I've collected are being archived and photographed and measured. And I've got a huge library of books, and they're being all listed. eventually they'll go to a place called the Crafts Study Center in England. That's what's occupying me most of the time. And the bits of work that I do are in ply splitting, making these bracelets and necklaces and things.
I understand that you also work with your son. He's taken over the rug weaving. How did that come about? What has that been like for you and your son?
He was always very good at doing things. When I taught at Haystack, I think I taught spraying, and he was only 5 or 6 or something. He was learning faster than the students and showing them how to do things. So he was always very good at manipulating things. He tried to make a living with a pop group, which I think they had 3 records, but he realized he couldn't do that. Then I said, if you like to work for me, you can live in a... We had a sort of barn in the garden. He did that doing my designs to begin with. Then after a bit, he became totally separate, just using the workshop, but having no connection. He does his own very, very good designs, much more fluently than I ever did them. He's not interested in techniques the way I am, but he's very, very much better at designing, I think. And he does a lot of teaching. He's away at the moment. He lives in Colchester and comes in every day. We share the workshop.
Thank you so much for taking time out of your schedule to talk to us.
That was fine. Thank you. Bye.
There is a risk associated with going to weaving conferences. It is an affliction that is passed from weaver to weaver. It's a socially communicable disease and can be picked up by going around and test driving looms. Yes, I'm speaking of the heartbreak of
loom lust.
I came back from Convergence and Complex Weavers very excited about the kind of loom I wanted. I wanted something 24 shaft and 48 inches wide and computer driven, and I sat down and priced it out. $14,000. Do I need to tell you that was not in my yarn budget? Yeah. So I kind of fell upon the couch and bemoaned my fate. And then I thought about something I discussed previously on Weavecast, being loom locked, and the need to start selling off some of my looms. I was raised by a mom who was an inveterate yard sailor. And over the past 5 years, I have picked up quite a bit of weaving gear, often at a very good price. I had attachments to this gear that were both emotional and financial. Like, if I get rid of that, there's no way I could ever get that back. But I was loom locked, so I had to start selling some things. So I put some of my looms up for sale on the internet. And a really interesting thing happened. The people who bought my looms, they were really happy and excited to get those looms. And often they were new weavers. In one case, by complete coincidence, the person who bought one of my 8-shaft looms was a brand new weaver that I taught to weave back in February. I taught a rigid huddle class. She took it. She got bit by the weaving bug. So did her 8-year-old daughter. Boom. 8 months later, she's buying an 8-shaft loom. How cool is that? And I had an 8-shaft baby wolf with a combi attachment. And if you're not familiar with it, combi is an electronic interface made by Schacht to fit on their baby wolf looms and turn them into electronic looms. And they don't make those anymore. And you don't see them come up on the weaving list very often. And I thought, if I sell that, I will never get it back. But the person who bought it turned out to be a friend of mine and a very cool lady. And I know she will enjoy weaving on that loom because she has a very technical mind. And I realized that by letting go of some of these looms that were not my perfect loom, I was giving other weavers access to what might very well be their perfect loom. And that made it easier, and it kind of opened the floodgates. And once I had a small pile of money from selling off my looms, I started looking around at my house. My husband had been encouraging me to get rid of stuff so that we'd have more space, because our house is not large. And between my hobbies and living here for 11 years and all the baby stuff we'd never gotten rid of, it was pretty cluttered. So I turned to him and I said, "You know that old car moldering outside that you've been after me to get rid of?" And he said, "Yep." I said, "If I sold that, could I put the money towards a loom?" And he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, if you'll get rid of that, you can put the money towards a loom." And I said, "You know that junk that's in the garage that you've been after me to get rid of?" And he said, "Yep." I said, "If I had a yard sale and sold all that, could I put the money towards a loom?" And he looked at me and he said, "Yep." So within a week, the car was gone. And 2 weeks later, the yard sale happened. And I found big jars of change and took them in and turned them in. I sold things on eBay. I sold things on Craigslist. Basically, I looked at my life and all the stuff in it. And I said, how much of this am I just hanging on to because it's there? And how much of it supports what I want to do in the future? And I took all the stuff that was just there and I got rid of it. And it was like a miracle because the pile of money I ended up with, while nowhere near $14,000, was enough for me to buy a used loom. It's not quite the loom of my dreams. It doesn't have 24 shafts. It only has 16. It is electronic. And I am very excited about it. If you want to see the stats on my loom, I will have a link to it on the show notes. You can go up there and check it out. I am so excited. So if you find yourself with an intractable case of loom lust, I recommend as a cure taking stock of your surroundings and figuring out if there's any way that you can finagle things to get a little bit closer to your dreams. That's all for this episode. So until next time, it's time to get warped, because everyone knows you have to be warped to weave. Weavecast is brought to you through the generosity of our donating listeners. This episode, I'd like to thank Gina, Janet, Valerie, Dorothy, Betsy, Rachel, Margaret, and Ruth. Thank you for helping support Weavecast. Our sponsor this episode is Complex Weavers, helping you take your weaving to the next level. You can check out their website at www.complex-weavers.org. Our musical guest this episode, Complex Tactics by Ben Bass. I thank this artist for sharing their talents on the PodSafe Music Network.